Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today was born in Bangladesh and after an international upbringing is now based in London. As well as having published three successful novels, she's written for The Guardian, The New York Times and The New Statesman. While her early novels painted detailed portraits of the Bangladesh War of Independence, her new book transports us to the centre of the technology world, an area she knows something about as she's on the board of Roli, a music startup company founded by her husband. The following conversation was recorded at Hay Festival, Wales. Tamima Annam, welcome to Meet the Writers. This lovely, lovely book is a huge leap from your trilogy, which was all about the Bangladesh War of Independence. It's a completely different style of writing, too. What prompted that change of direction?
Well, I was talking to my husband about this, and he said, in life, you're all about the comedy. So it sounds much more like you than your other books. Because I was feeling like, is this book me or are the other books me? And I think sometimes, I mean, you know, I've had a very complicated relationship to Bangladesh, which is the place that I wrote about for 10 years and which I will always write about again. It's my home. It's my kind of spiritual home and my actual home. But I have had a very peripatetic life. I've been a nomad and for the last 10 years, I've been on the board of this startup and involved in the tech world and in the business world. And, you know, one of the amazing things about being a writer is that you have somewhere to put everything. So I was having all these experiences sitting in board meetings, and I just thought, I'm going to have to write about this. And that's what I did.
And here you've done it. It's wonderful. Now, the main protagonist is called Asha Ray, and she's wonderful, I think. Tell us about her.
So Asha is like, again, one of the privileges of being a writer is that you can put yourself into people that you didn't get to be. So Asha is a coder. She's a scientist. She's also the daughter of immigrants. She grows up in Queens. And she just has a kind of sass that I wish I had had when I was, you know, 20 years younger or any time in my life. So I sort of got to create this very feisty character who she has big ambitions, basically, and she wants to put empathy into artificial intelligence. That's her big thing that she wants to do. But then she meets her high school sweetheart and they fall in love and he's a really interesting person. He creates secular rituals for people. So if you're not a religious person, and I'm not a religious person, but you still kind of crave ritual, like you want to have a christening, a baptism, or a funeral, something that represents you that is not tied to a religious tradition. He was creating these bespoke non-religious rituals. And she basically takes that idea, turns it into an algorithm, and launches a social media platform, and it blows up and becomes the next big thing in tech.
Could you read to us, because I think this passage perfectly shows us an example of those rituals, and it's also the moment she re-encounters him.
Yes, I would love that. It's right from the beginning. So, 4 years into my PhD, at the start of another summer of research in my overly air-conditioned lab, I was informed that my high school English teacher, Mrs. Butterfield, had died. When I got the message, a text from an unknown number, I was reminded of all the times I'd meant to write to her but never had. The message said, "Please bring a sentence from a favorite novel to Mrs. Butterfield's service." An invitation followed. I'd never been to a white person's funeral, but I knew I was supposed to wear black, so I put on a turtleneck and spent the ride down from Boston, rolling my chosen sentence around in my mind. When I entered the auditorium, I saw some familiar faces. A few teachers, the principal, Mr. Gatney, Iris and Ruby, the twins who formed a band my senior year called One Placenta, and even some of the boys who were never seen without their shiny varsity jackets. I said some awkward hellos, silently judging everyone, yet annoyed when they didn't remember me. We shuffled into our seats, the lights went down and up again, and standing in the middle of the stage was Cyrus Jones. His head was bent over a microphone. Mrs. Butterfield's family, her niece Elizabeth and her nephew Constantine, were sadly not able to travel from California to be here, and they asked me to conduct today's celebration in their stead. He spoke slowly, and it sounded like he had a slight English accent, and I was going to have a stroke. "You will remember Mrs. Butterfield as the teacher who impressed Shakespeare and Hemingway upon you," he said. "You will remember that she drove to school every morning in her pristine Volkswagen Beetle. You will remember her kindness and her solitude. As she passes, we celebrate all of this, but it also gives us an opportunity to celebrate what we didn't know. Death gives us the chance not to complete the picture of a person necessarily, but to contemplate the unknowability, the strangeness of others, even our most intimate friends. And what better way to do this than through fiction, the human endeavor that cleaves itself most closely to the mysteries of our lived experience? Cyrus gestured, inviting us all onto the stage. The lights changed. He faced each of us in turn and moved us around into a circle. When he reached me and looked into my eyes and whispered, "Asha Ray?" All of the blood pooled in my legs. "Hello," I breathed. Finally, we were assembled. Cyrus asked the person on his left to begin. "Do not go gentle into that good night," they said. Cyrus nodded to the next person in the circle. Good night, parting is such sweet sorrow." Then, "I'd rather learn from one bird how to sing than teach 10,000 stars how not to dance." I was last. Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. The lights went down, and in the darkness Cyrus whispered, "Jaina, Mrs. Butterfield, to most of us, and I spent a lot of time talking about death. Her final words to me were, 'The Prince of Darkness is a gentleman,' and I knew when she said it that her pain was coming to an end." I couldn't believe that he was right there, being a real person. And while I had no reason to hope this was true, I felt like maybe he was thinking the same thing about me. He looked so different than when I saw him last. The basic facts of him were still the same: the lanky, long torso, the angle of his jaw, his wavy, calligraphic blonde hair. But everything had slowed down. He was beautiful and older and completely perfect. I'll stop there.
Oh, and everybody, when you read that, I felt in love with him. tell us more about him.
I think the interesting thing about Asha and Cyrus is that she meets him when she's in high school, she falls in love with him, and then she literally creates an algorithm that makes the entire world worship him. And I think it's kind of like an exaggeration of what we do when we fall in love. We want to lift the other person up. She just does it in a sort of really huge kind of way.
Tell us about Way.
Yeah.
We are infinite.
Right. So she starts this tech company. It's called Why, pronounced as in why are we here? But it's written WAI, stands for We Are Infinite. And it does exactly what Cyrus does. So she takes all of this data from all the rituals and novels and quirky little things that people might be into, and she puts it into this database, and you go onto it and ask you a series of questions like, what was the most significant event of your life? And, you know, what are your interests and what are your passions? And then it says, what would you like to do? And you could say, I want to get married, or I want to have a funeral for my father, or whatever. And this is what he was into. And then it gives you this ritual. And then you can form friendships with people who share the same passions as you. So it's kind of like the anti-social media, because you're sharing things that are deeply meaningful to you, not the way that you might position yourself to the outside world in a more superficial way. And Cyrus and Asha and their friend Jules, who start this company together, are kind of like anti-entrepreneurs. You know, they come into it and they think, well, we're not going to be like everyone else. It was going to be free. They weren't going to make money off of it. And it just becomes much bigger than anyone could have ever imagined.
And Cyrus didn't really want to be involved in that side of it.
No. Sort of later, when he becomes the person that he becomes, sort of, you know, puffed up by all this power, he says to Asha and Jules, I didn't want this. You made me do it. And Asha not only creates this algorithm that is basically about Cyrus, but she encourages him to become the leader, to become the CEO. So he's the public face of the company. And then because it's about religion and about ritual, people sort of look to him as a spiritual leader.
I mean, you said right at the beginning that you're not religious, but I just wonder what your thoughts are on religion, particularly when you think about it pre and post pandemic.
I'm not religious, but I believe very strongly in the power of ritual and in the power of something that is beyond us to give us meaning and to give our lives a certain shape. And I think especially in the pandemic, I mean, I sometimes wish I was religious, because I think, God, wouldn't it be so much easier to be able to depend on a script rather than making your life up as you go and trying to figure out what you're going to believe in and what you're going to take and what you're going to leave behind. So I think it's very, very powerful, and especially in times of stress and crisis, which we've just been through. And I think we're all looking for community. I think we're all looking for connection.
Why did Asha feel that it was important to create an amalgamation of religions?
I think she was inspired by Cyrus, and Cyrus, she called him a humanist spirit guide. And he was like a magpie. He was taking a little bit of everything. And she tells a story. She says, you know, on Wednesdays he goes to like a Zen monastery, and on Thursdays he goes to a Gurudwara, and on Fridays he has, you know, sits down for Shabbos dinner. I mean, he's a person who likes to take a little bit from every tradition.
Mm-hmm. The book tackles huge themes. I mean, it's not just religion. It's gender bias, cultural clash, and of course race. Asha speaks often about being the brown girl and feeling invisible, and people are really surprised by her achievements. And I wondered if you could just explore that a bit for us.
I mean, I think the interesting thing about the tech world is that the big word in tech is disrupt. So, you know, people, entrepreneurs and startups, they want to disrupt everything. They want to disrupt the way you order a pizza, the way you drive. Everything about your life can be disrupted. So we take these ordinary, banal things that we're used to, like a mattress, and then suddenly there's a startup, and it's like, we're going to completely redo the mattress, and we're going to, you know, shrink wrap it and deliver it to your house in 2 hours after you've ordered it. But the thing that doesn't happen is that the basic structures of power are still the same. So there are still these young white men who run these companies, and the people who fund them are also part of the same power structures that have existed, you know, since the dawn of time. And so I found putting Asha in that place where she's really the brains behind the organization, and seeing how Cyrus eventually becomes the head and takes all the power, was just a commentary on, you know, that's really how power works, really.
Mm-hmm. And the racial side of it?
She's not only a woman, she's a child of immigrants. And it's funny because it's not just that Cyrus takes something from her. It's that she hands it over to him. You know, she keeps saying, oh, I'm just a scientist. I'm just the geeky person in the back. It shouldn't be me. And the story of the novel is her journey and how she starts to own her own voice and her own power and realize that she had basically, you know, she had created him, and that could have been her. She could have been the person that was fronting the whole thing.
Yeah. Now, the book is really funny. I mean, One Placenta, what a great name for a band by twins. But I felt, and correct me if I'm wrong, I felt that some of the reviews seem to imply that as a brown woman, you should have written more about race. They seem to be sort of slightly affronted that you'd strayed from the subject of Bangladesh. And I wondered what your thoughts on representative writing are.
That's a great question, and something that was on my mind when I was writing it. And I actually asked my publisher if I could publish under a pseudonym, because I thought, well, no one will ever take me seriously again because I'm writing this rom-com, basically. And I had this wonderful editor who said, there is a strong connection between your previous books and this one. And she really showed me that that was true. And I, you know, all of my books are about, you know, the trilogy was about three generations of women and a family in Bangladesh. And it's all about each one of those women finding their own power and finding their own voice. And that's what this is about for Asha. I'm sort of, you know, unsurprised. I think somebody like me with my background and my name is expected to write a certain kind of book. And it's a slight act of disobedience to say, oh, I want to write a rom-com and I want to write a book that a white person could have written. You know, this novel didn't necessarily have to be written by me. I just chose this subject. I'm going to claim a space that isn't necessarily something that you would expect me to claim. And I just have to stick to my guns and I think try to enjoy it for what it is. It's funny because as a writer, you have so many anxieties and also so many aspirations. And I think when I started out, I was like, I want to win prizes and I want accolades. And with this book, I just want people to think I'm funny. So when people say, I read your book, and they say, you know, say nice things, and I'm like, yeah, but was I funny? You know, that's really what I want to know. And they're like, yeah, you're totally funny. Okay, good. I don't care about anything else. I just want to make you laugh. And especially post-pandemic, I want to bring some joy into people's lives.
And of course, you've already won the prizes. You've won so many prizes. And so I wonder then if because obviously the reception to the books is different, how this feels for you. This is a whole different experience from your trilogy.
I think the joy of it is that I think this book has the potential to reach a completely different audience. And I just want to enjoy that. You know, I think I wrote that trilogy, I stand by it, and I love those books. I was also trying to work a lot of stuff out. You know, I'm from Bangladesh, but I didn't grow up there. My Bangla's not very good. I wanted to stake a claim to that place and say, hey, I really belong here. Look, I wrote these books. This is my home. And in this case, I feel like I'm staking a claim to another world. And hopefully people will join me on that journey. More people will join me on that journey.
Yeah.
Enjoy my jokes. So
now, Utopia is
yes.
where they go. Now, they're instructed not to talk about it at all.
That's right.
It's an extraordinary place.
We can talk about it.
But we
they
can talk
can't.
About it. Okay, well, let's talk about it.
So Utopia was inspired. I was very kindly offered a floating desk in a co-working space called Second Home, which is this place in London. There's a few of them in London. And it's the most beautifully designed space. I mean, it has no... The walls are all curvy. It has no angles. There's an indoor garden. There's like a pool, like an indoor lake, all kinds of amazing things to kind of boost your creativity. And while I was working there, writing my third book, I would overhear the conversations of the other people who were, because it's just a, you know, it's just hot desking. And one time I was standing in the queue getting a coffee and someone behind me said, I said the words digital and storytelling to her and she just threw money at me. So things like that I just thought were so funny. That joke didn't make it into the book, but it was, and so I was imagining a place like Second Home that I would call Utopia that would be populated with companies that were, their motto or their kind of mission was to protect against the apocalypse. So the person who runs it, you know, there's a guy who makes food out of electricity and there's people who are coming up with like behavioral changes that we can make in case there's a pandemic. And I wrote this part of the story before the pandemic, so it was really interesting when we actually had what felt like an apocalyptic event. So yeah, it's called Utopia. I made up all the companies. I gave them logos. I created a fake website for them. That was a super fun thing to do and just one of the joys of writing this book.
Oh, I mean, it really comes across. And then they go to find funding from other places.
Yeah.
And I love the one where they go and they have to trampoline across the floor
yes.
to get to the meeting.
I mean, it's funny because I think for people who are not in that world, it feels like the Wild West. Like if you go into a tech company's office, it doesn't look like an office. It looks like a playground and some of the things that they do. And I just kind of exaggerated those things. Obviously, I don't think there's an office out there where you have to trampoline into your place of work, but there could be. It's not completely beyond the realm of possibility.
So tell us about some of these brilliant startups. I mean, there are a lot of them that you describe. The faux fish pie and the vitamin smoke.
So one of the ones that's my favorite is actually based on a real thing. So this guy is called Rory, and he's a vegan activist, and he wants the world to become vegan. And he genetically engineers a tick. And if the tick bites you, you become really allergic to meat. And actually, this tick does exist. It's called the Lone Star tick. And in some people, if that tick bites you, you become allergic to meat. And he believes this will save the world. So imagine if everybody was bitten by this tick and we literally couldn't eat meat anymore. And so much of our, you know, dependence on the meat industry would go down. And, you know, so that's one idea. I mean, there are loads. There's one called Freud's. It's a match. We were just talking about dating services earlier. A matchmaking service. And it's basically, it doesn't ask you about your interests or about anything superficial. It asks you really deep questions like, how did your mother treat you? And, you know, were you held as a child? And it's things you just don't want to answer. But then it relies on the fact that connection is really about the subconscious and not about those surface things that we think are the root things that are bringing us together with people. And Freud's has a really good success rate, but nobody wants to do it because no one wants to answer those questions. So it ultimately doesn't succeed, unfortunately.
And so if it doesn't succeed and you don't find a partner, there's always Flitter.
That's true. There's always Flitter. I was wondering if you were going to ask about that. Flitter is a sex toy company, basically. But it's a very tiny device that fits in your handbag and that you can use anywhere, even in your place of work, discreetly, completely silent.
Like a little hair grip, you described.
Yes, exactly.
Fantastic. And then, of course, there's Consentify.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Consentify is an app where if you're about to engage in sexual activity with someone, you both consent to what you're going to do, basically, and all the places you're... So there's an image of a body, and then you touch all the places that you're willing to be touched, and then you do, like, a facial recognition signature, and then you can safely embark on whatever adventure you're going to go on.
Now, this app's being developed by Destiny, and this is a book about friendship, too, really, as much as about tech. And there's the main trilogy of Asha, Cyrus, and Jules. But there's also tremendous female bonds. What do you want to say about that? I mean, she has a great relationship with Destiny.
Yeah, I mean, I think that part of the whole purpose of the book was to show how Asha becomes herself, more herself. And I think her women friends are the ones that are really there for the whole journey. You know, they watch her go from being this sort of insecure, dorky, nerdy person who doesn't want to be in the limelight to the end where she really starts to understand what she's created. And they're a huge part of that. So, I mean, I think female friendships are like the great untold love story of our times. I mean, I think our, you know, for women, our companionship and our friendships and our intimacies with women are really what get us through all the stages of our lives, you know? Youth, having children, whatever partnerships we have, that's definitely true for me. So I wanted to have a little nod to that.
Yeah, as well as the love story. I mean, there is also a beautiful love story, which I don't want to give too much away, but do you think that Cyrus is a monster or a saint?
You know, I get a lot of mixed reviews on Cyrus. So there's people who say, God, I really hated that ending because I didn't want it to end the way that it did. Or other people who say, oh, why is she with him? Why don't they break up? I feel like women who are younger tend to say that, like, man, she shouldn't put up with that. You know, she should just dump him and take her place and leave him behind. And I think it's just up to you. You read what you want into it. I wanted Cyrus to be real. He does have a slightly cartoonish, you know, way about him because he's an exaggerated version of a real person where he's like kind of a messiah. But the love story is real, and whether they stay together or break up, I wanted people to really feel that, to really feel that there was something at stake there.
I mean, do you think that Asha could have stopped what eventually happened?
She tries really hard, so I think no. But I think what she regrets at the end is that she gave Cyrus all that power. And she volunteered him to be that person. And they had sort of jointly created the Cyrus that was in the public eye. So
yeah. Now, the other important person that we've referred to but not discussed is Jules, who's kind of their enabler in a way.
Yeah, he's like the person in the sort of little triangle that they create. Cyrus and Jules are best friends, and when Asha comes into the picture, Cyrus and Asha get married on a whim, basically, and that's not giving too much away, because that happens right at the beginning of the story, and that's how she actually becomes his wife. And then she moves into their house. So Jules is a WASP. He owns this big house. His parents have kind of written him off, and they've given him this big house in Cambridge, this drafty old mansion. And the three of them live there together. And, you know, there's this one scene where someone is meeting them for the first time, and Asha says, you know, this is Cyrus, I'm his wife, and that's his other wife. And I think Asha and Jules are the ones that really prop Cyrus up. And they're the ones that are really running the company while he's kind of going swanning around to his different chanting meetings and his different seances or whatever he's doing.
And Cyrus's relationship with Asha's parents is really interesting. And in fact, her family, I mean, the fact her sister wears a hijab, for instance, and the mother has a wonderful comment about that.
Yeah, she says her parents are horrified because I wanted to portray a Muslim immigrant family that is not the Muslim immigrant family that you think you know. Because I know a lot of families like this. They're not all the same. They're not all kind of, you know, trying to pass down tradition in a calcified way to their children. And in this case, Asha's mother is an actress and her father they run a pharmacy, but they're sort of want to be artists. And they say to their children, like, you know, the world is at your feet. That's why we came here. So why would you wear a hijab? Go out in a bikini, her mother says. But her sister does it because of political protest, basically. She doesn't want to be hypersexualized by the Western world as she sees it. And she feels a deep sense of injustice. So she's always out there with her kind of placards and protesting, and she's an activist basically, and Asha is the scientist.
Mm, mm.
And they're also very close. That was another thing I wanted to
portray.
It was
lovely. That sister bond really shines through. You talked about starting the book before the pandemic. Did the pandemic make you alter anything that you were writing?
Well, I had written this scene where Asha and Jules show up at Utopia, and they're told that the reason they're going to be invited to participate in Utopia is because Utopia is about the afterworld. So we're preparing for the apocalypse, and we think in the afterworld we're going to need something. Religion may not exist in its form, but we're going to need something like why to give people meaning. And I'd written that scene, and then we actually had a pandemic, and I thought, it's really a shame that if fate gives me the thing that this person thinks is going to happen, I can't not write about it. So I slightly changed the ending, and I put in a few scenes that are just, it's set in New York just before the first real kind of wave hits New York, where you're just sort of getting a sense that things are about to really, because when I was writing that, I had no idea where we would be, you know, in 18 months' time.
It's so poignant reading about the beginning when none of us knew, and it's such a lovely book. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed it. It really, really is such a great book. So in terms of researching the book, obviously the pandemic was real, it was happening. You've got all this experience in the startup world. You knew about that. You studied anthropology, so you know a great deal around those things. What about things like doomsday cults?
I didn't actually know a lot about doomsday cults. And the idea that the head of Utopia, Leanne, has about preparing for the afterlife was just, once I had come up with all the companies, I thought, wow, this is really a great way to tie them together. And also for Utopia, just like why, to be the sort of anti-capitalist, you know, tech incubator, because it's not just about making money, it's about actually giving people something really important, because the world is going to end. We're going to need food. We're going to need religion. We're going to need Flitter. You know, we're going to need all of those things. So,
yeah. I wonder if you could tell us about your experience of being a real startup wife. Explain what your app does.
Oh, well, it's not an app. It's actually a keyboard, and it teaches people how to play piano. So it hooks up to an app, and the keyboard basically lights up, and the app looks like Spotify. So you choose your favorite song. So you don't learn piano by learning scales right off the bat, or by learning the songs that we're told are the building blocks of piano learning. You choose whatever song you want, and then the keys light up to tell you how to play the song, and then you learn by doing, basically. It's changing the way. It's disrupting piano learning. I had nothing to do with that. My husband, Roland, is the brains behind the whole thing. And it's been an incredible journey. And I've been on the board of the company, I've worked at the company, and I've also been his wife. And I would say that the message there is that we completely blurred the lines between work and home. There was like no division. We live right next to the office. And I think what we've learned is that was amazing, because even after we had children, we had so much to talk about, and this very interesting, vital thing that we were trying to wrestle with and figure out how to make work. But I think, and then at some point we had to decide, okay, maybe there have to be some boundaries. So we decided things like, well, we're going to talk about work at home, but not in our bedroom, or, you know, not after 8 p.m., or to having little boundaries that became important. But it was all at the first 5 years, I would say. It was a complete blur. Everything was like one big mishmash.
I mean, and so very similar to, I mean,
yes.
Absolutely based on...
Totally.
Yeah.
Them just like having no, I mean, they're slightly more feral than we were, because they don't even have a house, and everything is kind of, they live at the office, they have sleep pods, and everything is built around their work life. So yeah, I definitely have had a big taste of that.
The Startup Wife by Tamima Anam is published by Canongate. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Nora Hall and Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. This conversation was recorded at Hay Festival 2021, where 300 writers and thinkers gathered to reimagine the world. All of this year's events can be found on Hay Player now at hayfestival.org, along with a schedule of upcoming events. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.